The bit about bound books is a dig at my wife because she thinks I'm an illiterate, but I'm really not. So it's really nice to be here. Is this too loud? It sounds too loud to me. Is it good? Okay. It's just a weird. Not loud enough. Okay. I'll build it out then. It's really nice to be here, and this is my fourth access, and I thought it was time to just stop sitting in the audience and ask snarky questions, which I've been known to do. And so I thought I'd get up here and let people ask me snarky questions. So that's a challenge, I think. And I was really glad that Karen made the allusion to a certain political situation, because I have my own Sarah Palin joke, which is a weird attempt at humor. But I'm really, really psyched. I mean, this happened after the fact, of course. I put the proposal in, got accepted. And then now I've learned that actually speaking at Access qualifies me to run for Vice President of the United States. Because I've transgressed that border to a foreign country, because you are a foreign country, not at all like us. So I'm really stoked, because I have political ambitions, because I think it's time for a librarian to storm the White House. So I thought I'd start this topic with a little vignette to sort of set the stage. So, like Amanda said, sorry, I'm a little flustered here. I have a background in the humanities, and so I have this, I've been trained in the barrage of written text to an audience. So I'm going to be reading as well as doing a little extemp. So I apologize in advance, since that's not really the tradition here. But anyway, so I thought I'd tell a small story, a small vignette to sort of set the stage for the talk. So a public university in a tobacco growing state, which shall remain nameless, created a service called Citation Builder, where a user can enter the bits and pieces of a citation, click a button, and have it magically formatted as APA, MLA, and so on. That's pretty slick, but it's not really revolutionary, since others have done this before. A larger, somewhat more powder blue university in the same state got their code, enhanced it, and rolled out their own edition while explicitly acknowledging the other university's contributions to the original product. So somewhat later, another public university in a wheat, corn, and beef producing state, which may or may not be Kansas, hired a newly minted librarian who is not me, who emerged from the powder blue university's library degree program. Well, in a meeting with us, where the topic of offering such a citation generator came up, she offered to contact the powder blue place and see if we could get their code to use as a basis for our own tool. And we promised to thank them profusely and share anything back that we did. You know, it sounds a little bit like sort of ad hoc open sourceness, except that, of course, it wasn't. Otherwise, I wouldn't be standing up here. Said university responded by asking us to sign and submit a software licensing agreement, which ran afoul of our processes, since we don't like to sign licenses that contain the usual offending clauses about state of adjudication and things like that. So long story short, in the end, we opted to develop our own citation generator. And so this is inefficiency piled on top of inefficiency. Citations and style manuals are constants. There's no reason for nor benefit to having everyone create their own citation tool for users. We lost the advantage of having their base code. Powder Blue, you lost the bonus of having someone refine their product for free, because of course, like all software products, we saw what they did, saw the mistakes, and said, well, we're going to make it better. So this is exactly the kind of library-to-library software sharing saga that gave me the idea for this talk and sort of poked me to throw in a proposal. I'd like to explore our collective experiences and maybe not so good experiences with open source software with this audience, where I've sort of found expertise in recent years and really value it. But before I really begin, I'd like to set a few ground rules that I'd like everyone to observe during my talk, and this is very important, so please, please don't take anything personally, because I consider myself as much a target for my criticisms as anyone else, and I hope that becomes clear. I say this not so much in jest because some of you in the room will feel yourselves spoken to by some of the examples I show, and that's just, sorry, I apologize in advance. The second thing is, please no audible expressions of disgust or dismay or exasperation. It's okay to roll your eyes, except maybe for this table, because I'm so myopic, I can't see you guys out there, so that's fine. And last but not least, if you have any throwable objects, especially forks and knives, please put them in a place where you can't throw them. If you throw a wireless mouse, please throw the dongle. I need both. So I think I'm kidding, but I'm not sure I am. I'd like to begin with I'd like to begin with a little background to show where I'm coming from and what I know about open source software and what I think about it. First and foremost, I am not a programmer. This is like a 12-step program for me to get to that point to say that. I never have been and I never will be, and that's even harder to admit because I always thought I really should learn a programming language and it's just a failure that I haven't, but I've given up, I'm too old or something. What I am is one of those librarians who is otherwise technically semi-competent. So, for example, I can install software on Solaris or Linux. I know what a shell is, and I sometimes find myself hitting, you know, Control, colon WQ in Word and wondering why it's not saving my document. And I can generally do something that I would refer to as sysadmin light. So you probably know people like me in your libraries and are disgusted with them. This makes it really easy for me to say that all code should be free and open, and it makes it easy for the programmers among you to shred me to pieces in the Q&A. So please be very nice to me. Beyond that, as a lot of you have, of course, I've spent many productive and a lot of not so productive hours wrangling vendor software, ILSs, link resolvers, federated search suites, and so forth. So I have this head full of lessons and ideas based on all that fun. As a result, I'm less concerned with where the software comes from and how it's licensed than with how well it functions and responds to the real demands of users and staff. I won't be covering the general broad topic of open source software since that's just way too broad. As Dan Chudnov, and it feels really weird to cite Dan here, so I should just call him Dan. Is it okay if I just call him Dan for the rest of this? Because I called him Chudnov, and that just seems way too formal. So Dan is Dan Chudnov, for those of you who don't know. As Dan points out in his chapter on open source in the book Information Tomorrow, open source software has, at least on many levels, successfully integrated itself into libraries, particularly when it comes to system infrastructure and programming languages. Things like Apache, PHP, MySQL, Lucene, so on, are clearly essential components of library services. Additionally, libraries and librarians have strongly embraced certain consumer open source applications such as Firefox and Thunderbird, OpenOffice, as well as object repositories such as DSpace and Fedora. So that's all fine and good. But where we tend to fall flat is in the area of creating, maintaining, and sharing library-specific applications built on those backends. There are certainly myriad exceptions to this statement, and I'm sure a lot of you will tell me all about them. But I would suggest that however large and noteworthy, they remain the exceptions and not the rule. We also miss the boat on sharing what I'll call open source light, tiny programs written in various scripting languages that drive all the doodads and widgets on our websites, Web 2.0, or extend, or in some cases repair, the functionality of our commercial systems. These are typically less than a couple of hundred lines and are often deemed lightweight and insignificant to those who write them. But for the many librarians who lack access to programmers, they can be a godsend. Collectively, they represent hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of valuable work time. Even those libraries rich in programming resources can benefit from not having to create everything on their own. Were we businesses, thankfully we're not, we would not be able to sustain this inefficiency. So as organizing concepts for the rest of the talk, I've came up with these six organizing bullets, if you will. Perfectionism, so unless the code's perfect, I don't want anyone to see it. Dependency, which is if we share this with you, you will never leave us alone. Quirkiness, we'd gladly share it with you, but we can't because we're so weird. Redundancy, which is we think your project is neat, but we can do better. Competitiveness, clearly that came up in already. We want to be the acknowledged leader. And misunderstanding, which is a fundamental inability to understand how an open source community works. And I think this is very, very common among librarians writ large. Many of these issues, of course, can operate in combination, take any pick of them. But any one of them is sufficient to undermine or hamper the development and adoption of open source software. Perfectionism is perhaps the most obvious issue that arises with open source software and plagues mainly smaller applications that were developed by one or two people at a given institution. We have all encountered this type of programmer where untidy code, lack of code commenting, and sin of sins, inefficient or redundant code makes them unwilling to show it to anyone else who might be able to point out the flaws and correct them. It may seem trivial or out of place to peg some of our woes with open source software on the programmer's desire to hide the fact that they are indeed not perfect, but the issue arises again and again. One hears it mentioned in conversations with programmers and reads it in the messages one receives in reply to a request to see this or that snippet of code that a library has written to drive a service or enhance an existing software product. As someone who has personally written vast amounts of incredibly ugly and sloppy CSS, which of course does the job in the end, I certainly understand the urge to hide one's foibles, but with CSS that's just not possible, really, which is probably why so many library websites end up looking all alike, but that's a different talk. Even here at Access, where many successful programmers congregate, I've heard people at this podium, previous years, talk down their code and make self-deprecating jokes about it, even though it's perfectly functional and usable. There is always that fear that someone else in the room will know it better and be silently smirking at the fact that the person at the podium didn't know this or that trick. Expand that audience to the wide library world, and it's a wonder that any less than perfect code ever gets shared. Turning this issue on its head, however, it bears asking how many of us have actually ever heard anyone mock someone else's code, at least publicly. In my experience, programmers are generally grateful for any code they can view and learn from, even if in the end they choose to take an entirely different route to achieve the same results. So somewhat related to dependency, to perfectionism is dependency, which has the programmer and his or her time at its core. Nothing is more certain in the world than this. If you share software with someone, you will be asked to support it, even if you make it perfectly clear that you have no ability and no intention to do so. Much of this can likely be traced to how open source software often propagates through libraries. For one, oftentimes it is done through personal contact. Someone at University X asks someone at University Y for the code that drives this or that service. Being somewhat flattered, and at least temporarily overwhelming the little perfectionist beast inside them, the person at University Y happily complies and sends it off. Of course, when something goes awry, and something will always go awry because there are just too many variables in play, the person at University X will typically write a "sorry to bother you, but" message to the person at University X. Being nice people and service-oriented organizations, we try to assist them, but may end up becoming somewhat cranky about it since it detracts from our own work and yet does not add to our list of accomplishments. Another common route for the spread of open source software between libraries is through staff who use the software but are not involved in its creation or maintenance. For example, if a library successfully creates and/or implements an open source tool for something like tracking patron purchase requests, someone will likely turn this into a conference talk or poster session, which is like putting up the white light bulb in moth season. The systems office that implemented or created the software is suddenly thrust into a support role they neither sought nor desired, which only exacerbates the desire to hide one's code. I think there are at least two realistic ways to get out of this conundrum with dependency. One is to provide support more or less explicitly. I would suggest that the libx toolbar developed at Virginia Tech falls more or less into this category. From my point of view as a user implementer of libx, I'm certainly grateful that we have a functional toolbar to offer our users and a really slick and pretty easy addition builder in place to create and maintain it. But I do wonder occasionally about the sustainability on Virginia Tech's end for this product. The other path, one that I wish more libraries would follow, would be to post the code in some public repository, along with at least some vestigial documentation, take an hour or two. And that, Karen, of course, was pointing out just how often that gets skipped, so that the code can be picked up anonymously, which breaks that person-to-person chain and makes it clear that the code is being offered as a service, but support may not be forthcoming. Needless to say, it should be posted with an unambiguous open source license. This sounds easy enough to do, but it's not a reach to say that it rarely happens. And I'm going to pick on us at K-State for a while. We've had this page kicking around for years. We even spent a lot of time working on our little Library Labs beta logo because we thought it was really cool to call everything beta like everybody else. And if you can read this, I'm sorry, the text is so small. If you can read it, not everything on that list there that we were going to post here and document and share is, of course, our development. Some of it's just stuff we were implementing. But there are at least three things on there where we've written code, and two of them are actually quite useful and extend the functionality of a commercial system in really good ways. We're doing a really good job with this open source sharing. And not long ago, while reading the briefings of the most recent Coalition for Networked Information Task Force meeting this past April, I noted that Rutgers announced that it was planning to unveil their open source software sharing platform, which will purportedly manage the release, versioning, documentation, and so forth. And they were also going to launch their initial open source software offering, which is a Metz-based bibliographic utility. So I read that and went to their page, and if it's kind of small, more information coming soon, and it's been this way for months on end. So announced in April, and we sort of, obviously it slides down the priority list and never sees the light of day, or sees it much, much later. Libraries simply do not typically make it a priority to share their tools with other libraries, a failure that needs to be addressed at the management level of libraries. Perhaps the most maddening among the various reasons for not sharing software is quirkiness, or the sense that what an individual organization is doing is so unique and locally tailored that it simply would have no value to release the software to the broader library community. One would think that as institutions with a high awareness of standards, this would not be a major issue. Again, using a CNI meeting as an example, I had the opportunity to sit through a session in 2007 where the University of Maryland presented the digital library that they had built on a Fedora backend. I was really quite impressed by the features and tools they had created, and I naively thought that the question I posed was an obvious one, which was, when are you going to release the code? What they offered were a lot of reasons about why they couldn't do it. The main one was that they had used some idiosyncratic local metadata scheme. I said, well, fine, we'll change it out for our own scheme, but clearly there's a framework here we could use. They just weren't going to bite. They did say, though, if they had to do it over, they might reconsider that choice not to share it. And I thought, I wouldn't say made me angry, but I thought, why did I fly to Washington, D.C. to sit in a room to watch you present a tool that I have no access to? Showing me a screen with screenshots of how it's working is not, okay, great, so I can go back and say, we can do it with Fedora, somebody else did it, but I know that my university doesn't have the resources of the University of Maryland. It's a pipe dream. And so it was just kind of a wasted 45 minutes. I hope you don't say that about my talk. So this was, I think obviously this is a really unwise decision on their part. They now have applications that they have to support all on their own, entirely at their own cost, should their developers leave, which is highly probable given the wealth of opportunities in the market that Equinox is hiring. They may struggle to find others to maintain these tools. And even if they do find those people, will they find someone content to babysit someone else's application? Or will they find someone who wants to reshape it according to the context and frameworks that they know best? So they lose any potential benefits that could accrue from having others extend or refine their functionality. And it just goes on and on from there. Having worked closely with programmers at various institutions, so this is one of those lines where you say, I'm not a programmer, but I know people who are programmers. Some of my best friends are programmers. That's the line, sorry. I have a certain understanding for choosing this path. Programming is neither a trade nor a rote process. It's a creative art. There are myriad ways to solve problems and a bevy of languages and toolkits that can be learned and applied. Babysitting someone else's code or worse, being asked to clean up someone else's code written in a language one doesn't know well or doesn't like is thankless and uninspiring work. It is much more interesting and enriching to create applications and build something that is one's own. The flip side of quirkiness is redundancy, which is when there is perfectly acceptable software available and yet it is rejected because it's not quite what one would have done had they created the software. In simple terms, this is reinventing the wheel. This could also be called the big challenge dilemma. Librarians who are not programmers or systems administrators want services, and they want them delivered on time via the path of least resistance and preferably the path of least cost. Programmers often want to step back and look at the big picture. They are systems thinkers for the most part, with strong opinions about the best way to build and maintain a system. They tend to value process and projects over immediate products. There's also, and if you've ever fallen prey to the big challenge dilemma, just sit on your hands for the next 30 seconds. There's a bit of arrogance at play here. It's very tempting to look at software, identify its flaws, and declare that one could do better. After all, the perfect piece of software has yet to be written. Although, personally, I think Minesweeper came like this close. I mean, that's like digital heroin. I mean, lights out. But the reality is that libraries and universities have very limited resources, and they often have to make compromises to be able to sustain all of their services. It's more than likely that the software that results from this line of big challenge thinking will evince different but equally obvious flaws. How many of us work at universities, and you can put your hand up or not, but you know, I think you know who you are. How many of us work at universities where some IT entity or authority has declared that the software available for a given task, whether it be commercial or open source, is unsuited to the unique situation at hand? What ensues is often a multi-year exercise in wheel reinvention, which often does not end very happily. The most egregious example of the big challenge dilemma was several years ago when the University of Wisconsin system abandoned years of work and more than $26 million invested in building their own payroll management software on the basis of less than ideal software, trying to mash something into place, and opted to sign a contract with Oracle. This got them a front page article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is, you know, go Badgers. That was great press. I'm sure they were really happy about that. The university where I work has also fallen into this trap. The university refuses, through its legal office, to sign on with iTunes U as a podcasting platform, and I know that you can make pro and con arguments there. And we chose instead, they chose instead to write their own platform to compete with Apple. Oh yeah, that's going to work. A press release went out, which was issued in 2006, and it was picked up by the Chronicle of Higher Education, more national press embarrassing us, which declared that Kansas State was about to become the educational podcasting capital of the world. That's pretty funny. I'm not sure whether we're the capital, but it's not podcasting. Not long after that, the head of the office tasked with developing this Wunder platform remarked sarcastically in a meeting, "We don't need no stinking iTunes." It's like, wow, let's draw our guns and start shooting. But anyway, this was over 2 years ago, and there is, of course, no discernible progress on the issue, and there's no code, there's no beta, there's no alpha, there's no pre-alpha. It just died. And of course, faculty still clamor for iTunes U and ask why we won't sign. So, I mean, the need's there. And I'm sure a lot of people can probably relate to this. So moving back to libraries and to open source software, I would suggest that one concrete manifestation of the big challenge dilemma is the emergence of the Open Library Environment Project. Its goal, as we know, stated, is to define and develop an open source integrated library system geared toward academic libraries. We're sitting in a room, as you know, with representatives from academic libraries who have either implemented or are about to implement an open source ILS, as well as a number of people who are active developers for the same. While reading up on the Open Library Environment Project and reviewing the list of partners, it was not without some degree of schadenfreude that I read the first comment on that page, which noted this project appears to be reinventing the wheel. Elsewhere on this site, a commenter asked about adding functionality to an existing open source system rather than starting over. It's on the screen. I empathize with the commenters, but what seems to be in play here is the notion that neither Koha nor Evergreen was their idea. So all they can see are the flaws and quirks that they will, of course, not repeat. It's hard not to see this as another instance of big challenge thinking. And while it would be mean-spirited and kind of nasty to wish them ill, it seems unwise to fragment what fragile momentum there is towards the open source ILS and academic libraries by creating a new fork, a new path that sort of draws people's attention and makes them all go, "Oh, let's wait for that to do something. Meanwhile, there's this thing sitting here we could be using now, but we can sit tight for 2 years." I actually heard that in a meeting 2 weeks ago. I'm not just making that up. One could also view the open library environment as an example of a bit of competitiveness. Competition can serve a purpose as it fosters innovation and increases the pace of development. It can also sap resources. And in the context of libraries, where we have no access to venture capital, other than, you know, if you consider the Mellon people sort of quasi-venture capitalists, I guess, maybe we do, and we can't generate our own revenue, clearly collaboration is to be preferred to competition. Most libraries do not have a budget line item for research and development, and so we scratch together bits of money from various sources to drive our development projects. While grant funding, such as the Mellon money driving the OLE, is a wonderful thing, it comes with its own problem, namely, how to sustain the project beyond the scope of the grant. How many things die the day the grant ends? Having a limited set of partners is acceptable while the money flows, but you need a mass community to keep things going. I can't speak directly to the Canadian context, which I think disqualifies me for the vice presidential office, but maybe not, because she doesn't seem to know anything either. But in the United States, much of the competitive spirit between universities arises, very, very sadly, from our sense of athletic competition. I thought about taking this out of the talk, but then I realized that every meeting we have with the University of Kansas, which sits 90 minutes from us and sucks millions of dollars from the state just like we do, every meeting is laced, and we waste airtime talking about Jayhawks versus Wildcats. And not being from Kansas and not giving a rip about that, I just think, could we talk about work and stop posturing and posing and saying, "Well, oh, you do that because you're Wildcats." It's not a joke. It's quite true. It actually wastes time. And having been at I look at Birken as I say this, having been in a different league before, that competition runs to the bone in a certain Eastern elitist league. There's a lot of competition going on there. This competition extends to libraries, where we all dutifully build our own institutional repository, our own digital libraries, and develop our own web services for our users, often with little regard for what's going on down the road. How many libraries have invested how much labor in getting an IR off the ground? What results has this intense investment brought most institutions? These are questions we do not ask, at least not out loud, for the most part. We need to move past the notion that partnering and using the tools at hand is tantamount to capitulation. Let the sports teams fight out the internecine issues. They can certainly afford it. Perhaps the most vexing issue that plagues open source software and libraries is a simple misunderstanding on the part of many librarians and library administrators about the nature of open source. Many librarians have acculturated to an environment where our software needs are met by using a product from an established vendor that has a large booth at one of our major meetings. Any new technology that arises, be it open URL linking, federated searching, digital libraries, so on, will lead to the development and marketing of multiple vendor-supported options. On the one hand, this is completely understandable. Licensing a product from a firm removes many of the variables, provides stability, maybe, and does not require hiring too many people into libraries whose skill sets the typical librarian does not understand and cannot assess. On the other hand, we have a culture of complaint where we expect our vendor products to react immediately to every new development and to support our every whim and fancy. This is, of course, quite unrealistic and leads to myriad enduring versions of the "our OPAC sucks" meme. Open source clearly represents the remedy to this issue. If you need functionality, find software that comes close, hire some programmers, and get to work. Find partners, share code, collaborate. In the end, you significantly shorten the feedback loop between users, whether they be staff or the public, and developers, and can exercise far more control over the software than with a vendor. This sounds, of course, really simple, but it often fails because of the innate culture of many libraries. Having so long been in the vendor-driven rut, we cannot see our way out of that path. In that world, we are simply consumers of software. We pay our money and get a product. We provide feedback, ask for enhancements, but that is more or less the extent of our involvement in the development of the software. With open source, one can choose simply to download the code, install it, and start using the software. That's not likely to get one very far, even with simple software such as WordPress. There are versioning issues, customizations, security concerns, backup plans, bugs, and on and on. What often happens with open source software and libraries is that non-technical librarians and staff begin to view their colleagues down the hall in the IT shop as the vendor and simply continue reporting issues and asking for enhancements. I'm basically the support line for my library. This product's down, this is down, this is down. It's like, okay, what am I, you know, an 800 number or something like that? What they fail to understand is that with open source, they have the ability, and I would strongly argue, the responsibility to seek out their own solutions and participate in their implementation. They need not know all the technical details, but they should be able to articulate what they need, seek solutions from the community, and suggest how these would fit within their institution's suite of services. They might even consider helping with interface and documentation issues, which do not require programming skills. Essentially, it's at the point of shifting from being a consumer of software to being an active participant in the community that supports open source software that the misunderstanding hits its zenith. Librarians often have unrealistic expectations of open source software and do not recognize that by using it, they are tacitly declaring their membership in the community. A few examples may help illustrate this point. This is where I have to apologize to somebody that I think is sitting in this room and I don't know by face, so if you're close, miss, please. On a popular library technology blog last fall, there was a post about problems with installing an unnamed piece of open source library software. Within a few sentences, anyone familiar with the software knew what was being discussed. As with the author, I too had encountered issues when installing it some months earlier. Unlike the author, however, who only encountered one issue, I had encountered three. Rather than blog my frustration with the other two, I wrote back to the friendly people who created the software, offering a fix for one and suggesting that they remedy the other in their next release, giving them detailed feedback about what was missing. This is why the author of this blog post only had to deal with a third issue, which was a specific PHP dependency. I'm definitely not selling myself as a paragon of open source virtue. I crab and moan about software and most everything else all day long. The point is that it might have been more in the spirit of open source to communicate with the developers rather than vent this in public where anyone familiar with the software knows instantly what is meant and who developed it. It was interesting to read the comments, which were fairly split down the middle between here, here, and those noting that the blogger should turn her experiences into useful information for the developers, which, to be fair, she most likely did. And what's even more interesting is that most of the comments on that post were from people who are regular attendees at Access, and I think you know who you are. And that's an important point that I'll come back to in a second. The second example illustrates a far larger misunderstanding on the part of librarians when confronted with open source software. As reported in a summary in Technical Services Quarterly, Karen Calhoun presented It's So Cool, which is decoded up on the screen, at the ALA conference in 2004. Not surprisingly, she was asked if Cornell would share the program with other libraries. She responded by asking if the audience would prefer an open source or a shareware approach. And honestly, I'm not even sure what that means, but that's a different topic. Not surprisingly, the audience favored shareware, maybe because they're familiar with it, with the stated reason being that this was not only for the benefits of those in the audience who wished to use the program, but to Cornell by reducing their administrative costs and responsibility for the program. So I think this shows a rather glaring misunderstanding of open source, and for that matter, of shareware too. Not surprisingly, perhaps, neither of those options ended up being the path taken. Instead, It's So Cool morphed into WorldCat Selection, a fee-based service of OCLC. Well, one could correctly argue that this makes it more immediately accessible to more libraries, since we're quite accomplished at writing checks to OCLC, and I have this great collection of OCLC tote bags, so I mean, we get some return on the investment. In the long term, In the long term, it just adds another maintenance bill to the library's budget and consumes resources that could be used for other things, such as a programmer who could work on many other projects. It also puts the ongoing development in the hands of a single vendor. The third example involves an open source success, but one that has gone a bit off the rails. At K-State, we implemented an open source reference tracking software about 21 months ago, and it has been incredibly, excessively, wildly popular with our staff. And so led by one of our public services librarians, several of them have been quite evangelistic in promoting the software at various regional and national conferences. It's like an industry. She's incredible, this woman who's leading it. She just talks every 2 weeks. So what they've succeeded in doing is making us a focal point for questions about the software and its installation issues, even though we didn't develop it. What they have not done is assisted with making its development and maintenance a local priority. So we hold it together with duct tape and baling wire and hope that it doesn't blow up on us and deal with the support questions as best we can. This last example highlights the core of the misunderstanding that occurs in libraries. Essentially, there's a gulf between the technical people in libraries, whether they're librarians or not, and the non-technically inclined librarians, who often hold most, if not all, of the leadership positions. We don't communicate nearly as well as we should, and there's a profound cultural gap between the two camps that is difficult to bridge for many libraries. So it's been really fun describing what's wrong with our use of open source and snarking about it. But somewhere in the proposal, I did mention something about suggesting ways out of the jam. So this is the usual 3-minute, yeah, this is how it all gets better. So I'll start. What can we do? A simple way would be for us to agree on how best to share software between libraries. In this case, I would distinguish again between macro open source and open source light. The former concerns large and robust enterprise software such as Evergreen, Koha, OJS, DSpace, and so on. Those clearly have their own user communities and distribution channels and can take care of themselves. With open source light, it's much more Wild West. Some of it can be found on Google Code, some in SourceForge, but most of it lives in little pockets at hundreds of libraries, and we pass it around as email attachments. That's not very effective. While Rutgers had the right idea, with that page I showed, having every library post its own code on its own site is also not efficient. As I showed using my own library as an example, we had the best of intentions and really got nowhere with it. One promising development in this regard, which also happens to be an example of open source overlapping with commercial code, is the recently announced EL Commons, Ex Libris Commons, which happens to be intended to be a clearinghouse for user-created code that enhances Ex Libris products such as SFX and, I guess, Voyager. Having such product-centered spaces makes a lot of sense on many levels. For the rest of it, should we just avoid reinventing the wheel and use Google Code? One could do worse, but that doesn't make it very easy for the non-technical, those people who don't live in the Google Code space, to find and to understand. And sites such as OSS for Library are fantastic for the code wonkish among us, but are inaccessible to the 99.4% of librarians who don't attend conferences such as Code for Library Access. And that goes back to what I was saying about the comments on that blog post being access attendees. This is a very, very small subset of people who talk about and think about and deal with open source software in any sort of profound way. We go back to libraries, I suspect most of us, where the vast majority of our colleagues kind of look at the wall when we talk about this stuff and have no idea what we're talking about and say things like, well, is there a support vendor for it? Is there a support vendor for it? You know, the first question is, who's going to support it? You know, who can we call when things go pear-shaped? One solution, of course, would be to create a library-specific code repository, and that seems anathema even to me because it's potentially redundant given the options already available. If we want our not-so-technically bold colleagues to participate, it might be a necessary evil to lower the threshold, however. Even if we lack such central points, libraries need to develop a far more open-minded attitude towards sharing their open-source light. Going back to the opening vignette, I would ask what the purpose is of asking a library to sign a licensing agreement for a couple hundred lines of PHP, other than to demonstrate how beholden our thinking is to our generally risk-averse library culture and our vendor-oriented business model. If someone asks for such code, shouldn't the response be, gee, we're flattered, sure, here you go. Fix it, repair it, give it back, and oh, by the way, do you want to be a collaborator or a committer and help us out with this? Let's be nice about these things. Slap some sort of standard open source license on our software and pass it on without the pointless negotiations or stern warnings. This step is one of the two that's always skipped. The other one's documentation, of course. A more fundamental issue with sharing open source is that libraries that wish to use open source software need to understand the staffing commitment they are making by going that route. The care and feeding of open source software requires programmers, interface designers, and systems administrators. These people are often not librarians, although one frequently sees job ads asking for librarians who have such skills, as if library schools were actually cranking out such people in any quantity. As such, we struggle as organizations to define the needs, properly prioritize them, and make progress on finding the right people with the right skills. And even if we succeed in getting the right job posting out on the street, we don't commit to paying the salaries necessary to attract enough talented and experienced people. A related issue is the question of recognizing and rewarding staff contributions to the open source community. While there are surely exceptions, libraries typically have no reward systems for putting something out there that helps others. Rather, we tend to ask, "What have you done for us lately?" and do not want to hear about enabling other libraries to be better at what they do. These are largely questions of leadership in libraries and the necessity of moving past the traditional roles and obligations of libraries and embracing radically different organizations that we currently have. Leaders must have a new vision of using large software packages where the question isn't simply open source versus commercial, but if one chooses open source, how to provide the resources necessary to make it successful. As Dan pointed out in the conclusion to his chapter on open source software in 2007, it is, quote, impossible to run a library without software, but you can have a library without a building. This insight should force us to significantly revise how we set priorities as organizations, but the shift has been slow to develop. Sitting on the plane, I read over what I had put together so far and thought, my God, this is really negative and pessimistic. I asked why what I have observed bothered me sufficiently to brave coming up here and expose myself, figuratively. It's because there's an earnest and pragmatic consideration at the core of my concern, which is our financial future. There likely isn't a library in North America not facing chronic and ever-worsening budgetary concerns. Every time cereals go up or fuel prices send us and our funding bodies into a collective tizzy, our ability to do the things we lay out in our strategic plans contracts. On the IT side of the organization, we often do not get approval to recruit for the positions we need, or even if we do, we can't offer sufficient salary to fill them, at least not for very long. And trading the acquisitions budget for software and staff to support it just seems like recreating the problem. It's often said that we need to become more efficient organizations. If you were at Access last year, that's funnier, I think. But It's often said that we need to become more efficient organizations, and the area of IT in libraries is one of the more underexplored areas for efficiency, given its relative youth on the budget sheet and the fact that some, I'll call them legacy administrators, have difficulty understanding the IT puzzle, let alone how to create efficiencies in it, and that cultural gap gets in the way. Open source is clearly part of the answer to this dilemma, but not if it turns us all into isolated, and in some cases, competitive software development shops. I'll stop there, and thanks for your patience, and not throwing things. Exhale.